Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The day before Thanksgiving in the year 2020, after an incredible election and election aftermath, joining us to pick apart some aspects of our politics today, Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I am doing well. And Megan Goldberg joining us as well, assistant professor of American politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Megan, so good to have you on board as well.
Thanks, Ben. Excited to be here.
And as a part of our reach out to listeners, perhaps to make it more appealing to call in today and join, I have a little puzzle because President Biden gave his first sit-down interview yesterday, President-elect Joe Biden, I should say, talking with NBC's Lester Holt. He says that the country needs to be in a better place in politics. Here's what he said.
I want this country to be united. The purpose of our administration is once again united. We can't keep this virulent political dialogue going. It has to end.
Okay. President-elect Biden, we can't keep this virulent political dialogue going. I think that's a fervent wish of many Americans, regardless of your political party. How to do it? We'd like to have your thoughts on this. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. How can we have a less virulent political dialogue? More harmonious. I won't use the word unified. We know we're divided in a lot of ways, but what can improve our political dialogue in this country? 1-866-780-9100. Also, any of your questions on this presidential transition period for Megan Goldberg and Rachel Caulfield. Let's start off by talking a little bit about the national security team that was announced yesterday by President-elect Trump. Biden's teams have begun to coordinate with their counterparts in the Trump administration. News reports saying about 20 meetings taking place yesterday, including at the Department of Homeland Security, the Education Department, the White House, gave approval finally for Biden to receive the president's daily brief, that summary of high-level intelligence. I think we heard in the news there, the first one due for the president-elect on Monday. Yesterday, though, the president-elect declared America is back. He introduced his national security team. These nominees, all Washington veterans, many with former ties to President Obama. And let's hear what Joe Biden had to say about this team before they spoke individually. Here is President-elect Biden yesterday.
It's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, once again sit at the head of the table, ready to confront our adversaries and not reject our allies, ready to stand up for our values. They embody my core beliefs that America is strongest when it works with its allies. Collectively, this team has secured some of the most defining national security and diplomatic achievements in recent memory. And while this team has unmatched experience and accomplishments, they also reflect the idea that we cannot meet these challenges with old thinking and unchanged habits.
Okay, the president-elect there announcing his national security team, including Antony Blinken, the next Secretary of State, also Alejandro Mayorkas to be Homeland Security Secretary, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, Avril Haines to serve as the Director of National Intelligence, the first woman to hold that post, former Secretary of State John Kerry to be the Special Envoy on Climate Change. Maybe we'll hear some of their voices in a few minutes. But Rachel, start us off. What do you see in these picks and the messages that the president-elect delivered with their introductions?
Well, it's pretty clear that the new Biden administration is looking to set a new tone and tenor to American relations abroad, but also at home. These are people who have served in government, who have extensive knowledge of the agencies in which they will be operating. They bring a depth of experience and expertise to their jobs. And they also reflect the diversity of the country. And so it is a decided shift in terms of how government can be organized around kind of weedsy, you know, in the weeds policy knowledge, and how that knowledge can be brought to bear to advising the president on these issues.
Mm-hmm. Biden's nominees, really a departure we're seeing from President Trump, a cabinet. His cabinet consisted largely of men, almost all of them white. Biden's picks, on the other hand, include several women, people of color. Your thoughts on this, Megan?
Yeah, I completely agree with everything Rachel said. I think that this shows a departure on two sort of important dimensions. One is actually the policies related to national security that, you know, we're seeing sort of an end of isolationism, that Biden recognizes sort of the rising power of Russia and China as threats, and his approach of his national security team is going to be more consensus building, developing allies, and rebuilding sort of those relationships internationally. But then also sort of this broader dimension of sort of bringing back and really emphasizing experience and expertise, because you know, and sort of highlighting the importance of having that experience in the bureaucracy and in his cabinet. So I think those are sort of the two central dimensions that we see that departure.
Rachel, I'm not sure how many of these that I named will need to be confirmed by the Senate. Of course, the Senate's balance of power hinging on those two runoff races in Georgia to be decided in January. What are your thoughts on whether we should expect problems in terms of the confirmation process for these top-level positions should the Republicans maintain a narrow margin in the Senate?
Well, you know, we're hearing some grumblings from Republican senators already indicating that they have some objections to some of these picks, so that's to be expected. So I don't think that's a huge surprise. Many, you know, one of the things that has happened in the U.S. Senate lately, just in the past, the past 2 to 4 years, is that there has been a loosening of filibuster restrictions around nominees, not only to the judiciary, but also to the executive branch. And so even with a Democratic minority in the Senate, there is some possibility that with some Republican support, confirmations would still be able to occur. And I would just note, one of the interesting things, in addition to the demographic diversity of this group of people, you have a lot of firsts. Right. For example, Alejandro Mayorkas, leading the Department of Homeland Security, first Latino and the first immigrant who will be leading that agency. But you also have a group of people here who, because of their policy expertise and experience in government, they are not the people that a lot of people on the far progressive left would necessarily choose. Many of them are pretty centrist Democrats. And so, you know, you might lose a couple of people on the far left for some of these nominations, but I expect, given given the names that have been put forward so far, I expect that confirmation should be relatively unproblematic.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Alejandro Mayorkas. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say yesterday when introduced by the president-elect, a lawyer, Mayorkas, nominated to be Homeland Security. Mayorkas is a descendant of parents who fled communism in Cuba. Let's hear a few of his words.
The Department of Homeland Security has a noble mission to help keep us safe and to advance our proud history as a country of welcome. There are more than 240,000 career employees who selflessly dedicate their talent and energy to this mission. Many risk their lives in doing so. the words on behalf of the United States of America meant everything to me and to my parents, whom I think of today and every day. My father and mother brought me to this country to escape communism. They cherished our democracy and were intensely proud to become United States citizens, as was I.
Megan, what do you think of this choice? Alejandro Mayorkas, a descendant of parents who fled communism in Cuba to be Homeland Security Secretary?
Yeah, you know, I think it's certainly interesting. And, you know, you never know how much people are aware of these choices. But it sends sort of an interesting message, too, I think, of inclusion, because Biden, you know, we're sort of still waiting to see how results, based on ethnicity and stuff shake out, especially in Florida. But there's sort of a growing feeling that Biden was especially weak among Cuban Americans. And Trump ran ads specifically, you know, sort of targeting or talking about communism in Latin America and sort of associating that with Biden. And so I think this is, in that way, sort of a clever signal to show that, you know, this is like an alliance, you know, with this group. Mm. And so I think that's a really interesting signal. Again, I don't necessarily know that it's that effective, but it's, I think, you know, perhaps part of the decision there.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to a caller, our first caller, Rachel, did you want to add anything to Mayorkas's nomination there?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I also think, you know, in addition to speaking perhaps to Cuban Americans, it may also speak to questions about immigration, right? For the past 4 years, immigration has been to a threat to Homeland Security. And so putting a Cuban immigrant in that position, I think, signals something about a shift in immigration policy as well.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. And at the start of the program, if you remember, I had a challenge for our listeners. What will it take to get to a better place with politics in this country? President-elect Biden said in his first interview with Lester Holt of NBC News, we can't keep this virulent political dialogue going. And I think many Americans would agree with that. Let's go to our first caller, 1-866-780-9100. Jay is with us in Cedar Rapids. What do you have to say to this challenge? How do we get to a better place, Jay?
Well, I think, Ben, just to put it simply, we need to kind of reverse course along the same path that has kind of gotten us here in the first place. And that being, you know, social media and, you know, I guess if you were to look at, you know, some of the social causes that we've undertaken as a society, that we've been able to see both sides of the political fence be able to get behind, like the Me Too movement and whatnot. I think that, you know, if we were to maybe put some serious effort or funding by corporations and the government as well, and public service messages out there about developing some course, you know, a civil course of debate amongst both sides, regardless of where you stand on either issue, but just being able to agree that, you know, there's a methodology that works and that's civil and that defines us, you know, what America's about and how this is all supposed to work. And if we were able to put some serious effort in a campaign, you know, as far as advertising goes, you know, by corporations and the government as well, into that, you know, I'm not saying to divert any of the negative stuff that's out there, or suppress anything, because then you're looking at weird free speech violations and whatnot, but, you know, trying to promote and fund and you know, flood the airwaves, whatnot, with the proper message and adopting a, you know, a general civil course of how we go about conducting business.
I think we got your message. Let's have our political scientists react to that. Rachel, what do you think of Jay's idea there? I mean, we need to learn how to discuss politics better in this country, more civilly.
We do need to learn how to talk about politics better. And I totally agree. I think there is a role for expanded public conversation about how to do this well. It is hard sometimes to have difficult conversations, but I think one of the things that we've lost that our caller is pointing to is the idea that smart people can reasonably disagree. And so building in some core ability to understand that just because somebody disagrees with you doesn't mean that they're stupid, it doesn't mean that they're wrong, and it doesn't mean that they're ill-intentioned. Certainly finding ways to do that is a way forward. You know, it's hard to combat all the negativity that's coming at us. And so how we're going to go about trying to do so, I think, is the big challenge.
Yeah. Jay also mentioned at the very start of his comment, Megan, comment on this, because of the social media, the way our media landscape looks compared to the way it looked decades ago with a few networks, network news or PBS you had, but these days you can find your own niche and just stay there, all comfy with whatever information is delivered there, not being challenged in your views. Megan, is there any way out of that sort of cul-de-sac of siloed views? If you don't share the facts, if you can choose your facts, so to speak, what hope is there?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And, some of the interesting contradictions are that voters still reward their elected officials for compromise. Those are some new findings. And so, but those sort of the bipartisanship that exists in Congress is not really covered because it's not as interesting as conflict, right? But on the other side, I think one thing that social media can tend to amplify is sort of the mechanism of polarization that comes from anger and threat and sort of like in-group and out-group feelings. That's one that's trickier because you are literally, right, in social media, you are literally forming networks of people. We do this in all aspects of our lives. We live by people who think like us. We surround ourselves with people that think like us, and we do the same thing on social media. And so, maybe the answer is finding a way for more exposure outside of your network, right? The algorithms that give you what you want, and, the explore page on Instagram, right, give you, different stuff, maybe.
Exactly.
And that's maybe the way out in terms of sort of specifically thinking about social media.
Okay, let's go back to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Micah, I hope I'm getting your name right, in Evansdale. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. My question is, I know you're talking about having unity between Democrats and Republicans as Biden's goal, but I was wondering what these new picks mean for unity within the Democratic Party itself and bridging the divide between progressives and moderates.
Mm, interesting. I think we touched on that a tiny bit, but let's go into that a little bit more. It's a great point, Micah. Megan, what are your thoughts there about progressive versus mainstream, so to speak, Democrats in these first choices by the president-elect?
Yeah, so I think one thing could be a little bit of a supply issue, right? Like some of the most high-profile progressives, people have been talking about Warren and Sanders as cabinet picks, right? But that weakens perhaps the Senate, right? Biden is hesitant to pull them out of the Senate because the gap is so narrow between the parties. I also think, though, that there are some nods to progressivism in those picks. So nominating Kerry in this particular climate position, I think Biden's position on climate change was widely praised by a lot of more progressive climate activists or climate scholars. And so giving climate an important role, I think, is a nod to progressivism as we are prioritizing this. We're not going to do all these other things at the cost of not paying attention to climate change.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to the former Secretary of State, John Kerry, now to be the special envoy on climate change. He says the world must come together to combat climate change.
You're right to rejoin Paris on day one. And you're right to recognize that Paris alone is not enough.
At the global meeting in Glasgow 1 year from now, all nations must raise ambition together, or we will all fail together. And failure is not an option. No one should doubt the determination of this president and vice president. They shouldn't doubt the determination of a country that went to the moon, cured supposedly incurable diseases, and beat back global tyranny to win World War II. This kind of crisis demands that kind of leadership again, and President Biden will provide it.
Former Secretary of State John Kerry, in his introductory remarks to be special envoy on climate change. Rachel, comment on this. Climate change, how has it changed in terms of, obviously this is going to be huge, from going to being called a hoax, a Chinese hoax in the last current administration, soon to be last administration, to being what seems, Rachel, to be front and center in this administration.
Absolutely. And among young voters, this is an essential issue. By the way, I like other people, have been calling John Kerry the climate czar. I always love the use of czar in our democratic politics. So I think John Kerry brings some really interesting traits to this particular role. He is not a progressive firebrand. And I think few people on the progressive wing of the party would name John Kerry as among their ranks. But he brings, first of all, a deep knowledge of international relationships and the importance of that kind of negotiation across borders and around the world. I think he brings a deep knowledge of Senate policymaking, so a very kind of pragmatic, how is legislation built and who does the work, who do you need to know? And he also brings a kind of a statesmanlike quality. He brings some authority and a voice with authority to the role, which I think is important. But to the point of unity around the party, he's obviously a longstanding top-level Democrat. He's addressing an issue that is absolutely central to the progressive wing of the party, but he brings the more establishment voice to that conversation.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment with more of our Politics Wednesday. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, and you, we're challenging you this hour. How do we get to a better place in our politics in this country? That's what President-elect Biden has in mind. We're asking for your thoughts. 1-866-780-9100. Back with Megan Goldberg and Rachel Caulfield, Politics Day, after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation ICOR Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's a pre-Turkey Day, Politics Day edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Megan Goldberg of Cornell College and Rachel Payne Caulfield of Drake University, our two political scientists, as we pick apart, a question I put to all of us earlier in the hour based on what President-elect Biden said in his first sit-down interview. He said, we can't keep this virulent political dialogue going. So the question, what will it take to get to a better place with politics in our country? Let me share this email from Darcy in Bettendorf. Darcy writes, I think one reason why Donald Trump got elected and that he got as many votes as he did in 2020 is that there are lots and lots of people who have felt left out of politics and political discussions. I heard many people say, Donald Trump says it like it is. I think these people felt they had someone in office that was more like them than previous presidents. I don't want their points of view to go unrepresented or have they feel that it's back to politics as usual, old white men, Washington insiders, etc. While I still disagree strongly with much of what Donald Trump said and did, I feel that half of our country needs to be heard. I think of a Venn diagram in which the left bubble and the right bubble have little intersect. I want that intersect bubble to be the biggest bubble. Megan Goldberg, there's an observation from Darcy in Bettendorf.
Yeah, you know, I think she's absolutely right about this, like, Venn diagram analogy, right? This is, like, it's not dissimilar to the graph that I show my students when I talk about what we mean by polarization, is that we don't have a lot of people overlapping in the middle, either, you know, especially when if you look at, like, Congress. You know, I think this observation about people feeling unheard in politics, I always think it's very interesting, right? Because it is coming after 8 years of a Democrat being in the White House. So in part, that's sort of a natural reaction in a lot of ways, I think. But I think that the evidence doesn't necessarily bear that out. Though that's perhaps a justification given, but the dominant correlates to support for Trump come down to attitudes relating to in-group threat, not necessarily economic threat, but more centrally, attitudes about race. And that, you know, I mentioned earlier this idea of, like, in-group and out-group with partisanship, and that intersects a lot with race as well. And so I think that that's one of the challenges in overcoming this, these obstacles of polarization, is that we do still have existing racial attitudes in the U.S. that are creating that division.
Okay, let's go back to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Scott is with us in Des Moines. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Hey, Ben, thanks for having me.
Sure thing.
My comment about the, I guess, the divide between people that really worries me is Murdoch-owned press. If you look at the difference between Australia and New Zealand, the fact that New Zealand works is because there is no Murdoch-owned press there. But my question is this. With folks like Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity, who are the main show on Fox News, Tucker Carlson specifically will repeatedly say things that are just not true. They're not based in reality. And when he is taken to court over these false statements, his lawyers successfully argue that he is entertainment and that no reasonable person could believe he is news. And yet so many Americans take what Tucker Carlson says as fact. How do we square this? How do we bring people back into the fold of reality that just love Tucker Carlson and listen to no one else?
Right, Scott. And I think that, good question. I think that's the same line tact you'll hear from Rush Limbaugh as well, that he's not doing news, he's doing entertainment. Rachel, what are your thoughts about what Scott brings up? Rachel, are you there? Rachel, I'm not hearing you. Okay. Megan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Can you hear me
okay.
now?
Is that you, Rachel? Yes, perhaps you could
it
go
is.
Ahead.
I'm we had sorry a... about that.
Did you have a mute button on, perhaps? Go ahead. Okay, well, Rachel seems to have disappeared. Megan, go for it, please.
You know, I think I hesitate to give too much causal leverage, I guess, to the press in particular. But I do think the trajectory of misinformation in the U.S. is concerning, and the degree to which we see that among commentators, and that there's not a clear distinction for viewers what is news and what is political commentary, which is what, you know, people like Tucker or Carlson are doing and what they say they're doing. And they make that distinction, but viewers don't hear it or see it. Mm-hmm. So I think I agree that is concerning. But I also think, I mean, it was sort of interesting to see over the last week or so what the limits of that were, because we actually did see people like Tucker Carlson pushing back on some of the claims of the Trump administration when it came to misinformation about voter fraud. And so that suggests that there are limits, and that's, I think, informative for us going forward, perhaps.
I think we have Rachel Caulfield back. It's also interesting what you raise. Yes, the limits there, Megan. I think some people on the right side of the political spectrum now saying Fox News is not doing its job and you need to go to Newsmax or in social media to Parler. Rachel, sorry about that technical difficulty, but you're back, I think.
I am back.
Share your thoughts on this point.
I think, I mean, we have a polarized media. We have a polarized social media environment. And I think oftentimes we ourselves view news as entertainment, right? it's easy, I think, to get sucked into the horse race commentary, into who's right, who's wrong, who's good, who's evil, and kind of play this game along with our commentators, our media outlets, our Twitter feeds, our Facebook posts. And when we do that, we perpetuate a kind of consistent environment of misinformation or misunderstanding that leads people to diametrically opposed positions. And so, at some point, finding ways to get good information is not as much fun. And so this is a responsibility, I think, that we all have. And I don't know exactly how we do that, except I do think media literacy is more and more important, and it's perhaps something that should be taken seriously from our very earliest educational environments to kind of get people to think critically about the media that they are consuming, why they're choosing to consume some media over others, and how to evaluate the claims that we see, how to recognize entertainment for entertainment's sake, and then step back from it and really evaluate information. It is essential to have an informed population. We are inundated with what we think is information, but so often it's actually not. It's not designed for that purpose. I'll end there for now.
Okay.
We'll see what else people come up with.
Okay. Politics Wednesday edition. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, if you've just joined us. Let's go back to the phones. Bernadette is with us in Ames. Bernadette, thank you for waiting and join our conversation. What would you like to leap into with?
Well, I'd like to echo what one of the other callers said about the media just kind of bombarding us with reminders about civil discussion and maybe some points. But also, I think our president-elect and our senators could help very much if they reminded people that name-calling doesn't help us come to solutions, that we shouldn't attack the other person because they disagree with us. Keep the subject on the problem and solutions rather than on the person.
Interesting. Thank you, Bernadette. And of course, Megan, comment on this. The present president in his final days in office made name calling and took it to an art form, if you want to call it that way. And so do you see a way to turn that back or a norm perhaps established in these 4 years, at least by this president being changed?
Yeah, so I think, opinion leadership is really important. And we saw that Trump was really effective at influencing the way people talked about politics. You know, some of that, maybe the roots were there, or the seeds were there beforehand. So I think it's right to want to look to our leaders to show an example of what civil discourse should look like. And that can be a really effective tool that people will follow their party leaders or candidates they support and follow their lead. And so if those candidates are taking us down a road of civil discourse, we could see that trickle down into, sort of our conversations on a daily level.
Right. We have about 10 minutes left of our program. Before the hour gets away from us, I wanted to make sure, Rachel and Megan, to get your thoughts on this. We had more than 3 weeks since Election Day. It's been nearly that long since Joe Biden was declared the winner of the presidential race. We had a current president peddling conspiracy theories, his campaign engaging in dozens of what turned out to be groundless lawsuits, a lot of fear about widespread civil unrest, about intervention in the judiciary or state legislatures. I wanted to get your thoughts, and to start off with you, Rachel, what has happened in the past 2 to 3 weeks? It is unprecedented. I'll put unprecedented in front of that to describe it. What else would you use to describe it, and where is this taking us?
Well, this has been one of unprecedented, certainly unconventional. So much of what happens in American politics has just naturally grown up over time. It's not constitutionally based necessarily. And a presidential transition is one of the circumstances, right? The Constitution says that we will have an election, the Electoral College will vote, the new president will be sworn in. But providing for continuity of government is kind of all a process of evolutionarily devising norms to create a smooth transition of knowledge and policymaking. And a lot of that depends, of course, on what the U.S. prides itself on, the peaceful transition of power. It depends upon a current president being willing to say, okay, I accept the will of the people, and now I will help make that transition as smooth as possible. And that is not happening. I think we forget sometimes that it's been 3 weeks since the election. It seems like it's been an eternity. But over the past 3 weeks, the president has contested every possible issue. There have been 24 lawsuits, all of which, well, there's still one ongoing, I guess. There's an appeal in the Third Circuit that's ongoing. But we're expecting a response soon to that. But I don't think it's, first of all, I don't know that it will have a lasting effect on the quality and integrity of the incoming administration. One of the things that I find most interesting is the degree to which this president is trying to foreclose policy options by the incoming president, rather than expand them. The tradition basically has been, once you know that there's a transition of power to a new administration, you halt all new regulations and new actions. You work in every way to keep the options of the next president open. That's not happening right now. President Trump is actually trying to foreclose a lot of policy options for the incoming president.
In addition to sowing doubt in the new president's legitimacy, we have 71 million some who Americans who voted for a second Trump term there. Megan, your thoughts on the question I just asked. What has been happening the past 3 weeks? There's so many takeaways. What do you pick there to mention?
So I think that what you just mentioned is a really important theme. I think that the writing on the wall has become quite clear that come January, Biden will be in the White House. I think any other outcome was probably unlikely, but it wasn't clear a week ago that that was the case. But I think that a lot of people are going to rush to say, well, look, our institutions have saved us, and the institutions did what they were supposed to do. But I think an important takeaway is that relied on a few members of the Republican Party in different states, in Michigan and in Georgia, to do what the law asked them to do, rather than caving into the pressure that they undoubtedly faced, that we know they faced from higher ranking Republicans. And so I think that, and that, all of that has also trickled down to voters. And so even if we sort of have this outcome that is the right outcome based on the election, that there is some irreparable damage that has been done, that it doesn't go away as soon as Biden gets in the White House, that there are people who think that this election was not legitimate to a degree that we haven't necessarily seen recently, and that we have set a precedent to not sort of follow those norms for a peaceful transfer of power.
Mm-hmm. Back to what you said, you mentioned there, Rachel, these norms. What I heard you say is we've had so many norms that have been abided by both parties, but they are not embedded in any law. So we have weaknesses in our democratic process on full display because of the current president's actions. Those have been revealed. Do you think those will be addressed? Will there be remedies? Do we have a Congress interested in pursuing any remedies?
I think we have some pressure to pursue remedies, and oftentimes institutional change like this and formalization of processes will come about because of popular dissatisfaction. And, the folks who are most, who are finding themselves most frustrated right now may not ultimately be satisfied. But I do think that certainly Democrats in the House have already talked about the ideas of reforming some of these processes, formalizing some of them and making them part of law. But, you know, there are also some key issues that if we step back from the current situation, we may actually find that there are good reasons for the way they exist. So, for example, one of the things that the president has done since the election has been to appoint people to a number of different boards, including the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Election Commission, the Federal Communications Commission. These are appointed positions, and they will last past a four-year Biden term. So those people are now in government. They are serving on those boards. Those are purposefully appointed positions that are not necessarily loyal to the president. And we have created a system where that's what's supposed to happen, where their independence from the president is essential to the job that we do or job that they do. And so I think, you know, stepping back and evaluating, I think you'll see a lot of projects to do that, whether or not ultimately both houses of Congress can get on board with a package of kind of systemic reforms. We don't know that yet. And a lot of it's going to hinge on Georgia.
Yes. And that's
and
that's,
if you thought Iowa was filled with campaign commercials, be thankful you don't live in Georgia.
Okay. Let's squeeze in one more caller at least. Tom is with us in Iowa City. Coming up on the end of the hour, Tom, sure glad you're with us. Please get right to the point. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. So the first thing is I'm an educator. One of the things I teach is the CRAAP test, which is how to evaluate media sources. What's the currency? What's the reliability, the authority, the purpose or point of view that the article is written in? I'm trying to teach students to be able to look critically at that stuff. The other thing, too, is I hear a lot of the right-wing bias and the Fox News of the world. But, you know, I'm a liberal Democrat. And when I would turn on CNN and I listen to Don Lemon or Anderson Cooper or Cuomo, see with Maddox, it's very one-sided. It's very editorialized. Yes. It's not
absolutely
news. And then the other point that I wanted to make is that in Iowa, we're really captive in that we have Gannett, who owns several of the media sources that I read regularly, and their editorial board can choose which stories to put on, put in the paper or not put in. Then you have Sinclair Broadcasting. So I think we're inundated with biases, whether it's an editorial board who chooses what news is worthy to print, or when we turn on any of the mainstream news sources, via the internet or on TV, they're all just editorializing. Where is the news?
Mm-hmm. That's my okay. Point. Tom in Iowa City, thank you for that final point, our final caller for today. This very quickly before we go, I promised at the outset I wanted to get Megan, your view and Rachel's view. The future of the GOP after Trump leaves the White House. Megan, please go first. 30 or 40 seconds is all I can give you.
All right. So the top line is, I don't know. I think that they are facing a question of whether or not they follow Trump's lead and sort of continue in that tradition, or they sort of try to rebrand their party in their own, you know, image rather than sort of following Trump himself.
Okay. Rachel, your view?
I'm going to take Megan's answer. I don't know. I don't think anyone knows right now.
I don't knows from yes. Educated political scientists. All right.
I think this is the magic question. I think you have people on both sides in the Republican Party who are going to be searching mightily to figure out what their future is.
All right. And what we're hearing right now is more and more GOP leaders making pronouncements, however timid, perhaps in some cases, Rachel, that Joe Biden will be the next president 3 weeks after the election.
Yeah, and I think this is exactly, you know, early on we heard that there were some in the Republican Party who recognized a need to kind of allow President Trump to have some time to let the outcome sink in, and kind of they wanted to be graceful about it. And now 3 weeks have passed. More and more states are certifying. The result is absolutely certain at this point. And so now is the time when they're willing to push a little bit. I think that was a strategy going in for a lot of Republican leaders.
Okay, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, thank you for joining us. To you, Megan and Rachel, and to all our listeners, stay safe. In terms of gatherings, smaller is better this year for the sake of all of us, all of our loved ones. Megan, thank you so much. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben.
Special programming tomorrow in this place, Turkey Confidential, River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving break.